Chapter 17. A Bronze Bear. Leaving Mistress Harfour and Master Norrie, Elaine started eagerly toward the map room, still holding Sidar. Eagerly, but not hurriedly. Denny and three guardswomen strode ahead of her, heads swiveling in constant search of threats, and the other four stamped along behind. She doubted that Dialin would take long over her ablutions, good news or bad. The light send that it was good. Birgitta, hands clasped behind her back and wearing a frown, seemed sunk in silence as they walked, though she studied every crossing corridor as if expecting an attack from it. The bond still carried worry and tiredness. A yawn cracked Elaine's jaws before she could stop herself. An unwillingness to start rumors was not the only reason she maintained a stately pace. There were more than servants in the hallways now. Courtesy had required her to offer rooms in the palace to the nobles who managed to reach the city with armsmen, counting armsmen loosely. Some were well-trained and carried a sword every day. Others had been guiding a plow before being called to follow their lord or lady, and a fair number had accepted. Mainly those who had no dwelling in Camelin, or, she suspected, felt pinched for coin. Farmers or laborers might think all nobles wealthy, and certainly most were, if only in comparison, but the expenses required by their positions and duties left many counting coins as carefully as any farm wife. What she was to do for the newest arrivals she did not know. Nobles already were sleeping three and four to a bed wherever the beds were large enough. All but the narrowest could take at least two, and did. Many kinswomen had been reduced to pallets on the floor in the servants' quarters, and thank the light, spring had made that possible. It seemed the whole lot of her noble guests were out strolling, and when they offered her courtesies, she had to stop and pass at least a few words. Sir Gaze Gilbairn, small and slim in a green riding dress, her dark hair lightly touched with white, who had brought all 20 of the armsmen in her service, and vinegary old Kelwyn Janivore, wiry in his discreetly darned blue wool coat, who had brought 10, received as gracious an exchange as did lanky Beryl Laden and stout Anthela Sharplin, though they were high seats, if of minor houses. All had written to her support with whatever they could gather, and none had turned back on learning the odds. Many looked uneasy today, though. No one said anything of it. They were all full of good wishes and hopes for a speedy coronation and how honored they were to follow her, but worry was written on their faces. Aralinda Brandstrom, normally so ebullient you might think she believed her 50 armsmen could turn the tide for Elaine by themselves, was not the only woman chewing her lip. And Laerid Trehand, stocky and taciturn and usually as stolid as stone, was not the only man with a furrowed brow. Even news of Gaibon and the aid he had brought caused only brief smiles, quickly swallowed in ill ease. "Do you think they've heard of Aramilla's confidence?" she asked in one of the brief intervals when she was not responding to bows and curtsies. "No, that wouldn't be enough to upset Aralinda or Laerid. Aramilla inside the walls with 30,000 men likely would fail to upset that pair." "It wouldn't," Birgitta agreed. She glanced around as if to see who beside the guardswomen might hear before going on. "Maybe they're worried over what's been worrying me. You didn't get lost when we got back. Or rather, you had help." Elaine paused to offer a few hurried words to a gray-haired couple in woolens that would have suited prosperous farmers. Brannin and Elvane Martin's manor house was much like a large farmhouse, sprawling and housing generations. A third of their armsmen were their sons and grandsons, nephews and great-nephews. Only those too young or too old to ride had been left behind to see to planting. She hoped the smiling pair did not feel they were getting short shrift, but she was walking on almost as soon as she stopped. "What do you mean, I had help?" she demanded. "The palace is changed." For a moment there was confusion in the bond. Birgitta grimaced. "It sounds mad, I know, but it's as if the whole thing had been built to a slightly different plan." One of the guardswomen ahead missed a step, caught herself. "I have a good memory." Birgitta hesitated, the bond filled with a jumble of emotions hastily pushed down. Most of her memories of past lives had vanished as surely as the winter's snow. Nothing remained before the founding of the White Tower, and the four lives she had lived between then and the end of the Trolloc Wars were beginning to fragment. Little seemed to frighten her, yet she feared losing the rest, especially her memories of Gaedal Cain. "I don't forget a path once I've followed it," she went on, "and some of these hallways aren't the same as they were. Some of the corridors have been shifted. Others aren't there anymore, and there are some new. Nobody is talking about it that I could find out, but I think the old people are keeping quiet because they're afraid their wits are going, and the younger are afraid they'll lose their positions." "That's..." Elaine shut her mouth. Clearly it was not impossible. Birgitta did not suffer from sudden fancies. Nerys's reluctance to leave her apartments suddenly made sense, and perhaps Rena's earlier puzzlement, too. She almost wished being with child really had befuddled her. But how? "Not the Forsaken," she said firmly. "If they could do something like this, they'd have done it long since, and worse than—" "A good day to you, too, Lord Aubrum." Lean and craggy and bald, save for a thin white fringe, Aubrum Pensinor should have been dandling his grandchildren's children on his knee, but his back was straight, his eyes clear. He had been among the first to reach Caemlyn, with near to 100 men, and the first news that it was Aramilla Marn marching against the city, with Nayan and Elania supporting her. He began reminiscing about riding for her mother in the succession, until Birgitta murmured that Lady Dailin would be waiting for her.
"Oh, in that case, don't let me delay you, my lady," the old man said heartily. "Please give my regards to Lady Dailin. She's been so busy I've not exchanged 2 words with her since reaching Caemlyn. My very best regards, if you will."
House Pensinor had been allied to Dailin's Taravin since time out of mind. "Not the Forsaken," Birgitta said once Aubrum was out of earshot. "But what caused it is only the first question. Will it happen again? If it does, will the changes always be benign? Or might you wake up and find yourself in a room without doors or windows? What happens if you're sleeping in a room that disappears? If a corridor can go, so can a room. And what if it's more than the palace? We need to find out if all the streets still lead where they did. What if the next time part of the city wall isn't there anymore?"
"You do think dark thoughts," Elaine said bleakly. Even with the power in her, the possibilities were enough to give her a sour stomach.
Birgitta fingered the 4 golden knots on the shoulder of her white-colored red coat.
"They came with these."
Strangely, the worry carried by the bond was less now that she had shared her concerns. Elaine hoped the woman did not think she had answers. No, that really was impossible. Birgitta knew her too well for that.
"Does this frighten you, Denny?" she asked. "I'll admit it does me."
"No more than needful, my lady," the blocky woman answered without stopping her careful scan of what lay ahead.
Where the others walked with a hand on their sword hilts, her hand rested on her long cudgel. Her voice was as placid and as matter-of-fact as her face.
"One time a big wagon man named Eldrin Hackley came near breaking my neck. Not usually a rough man, but he was drunk beyond drunk that night. I couldn't get the angle right, and my cudgel seemed to bounce off his skull without making a dent. That frightened me more, because I knew certain sure I was about to die. This is just maybe, and any day you wake up, maybe you die."
"Any day you wake up, maybe you die."
There were worse ways to look at life, Elaine supposed.
Still, she shivered. She was safe, at least till her babes were born, but no one else was.
The 2 guards at the wide, lion-carved doors to the map room were experienced guardsmen, one short and the next thing to scrawny, the other wide enough to appear squat, though he was of average height. Nothing visible picked them out from any other men in the guards, but only good swordsmen, trusted men, got this duty. The short man nodded to Denny, then straightened his back stiffly at a disapproving frown from Birgitta. Denny smiled at him shyly.
Denny? Shyly?
While a pair of guardswomen went through the inevitable routine. Birgitta opened her mouth, but Elaine laid a hand on her arm, and the other woman looked at her, then shook her head, thick golden braids swaying slowly.
"It's not good when they're on duty, Elaine. They should be seeing to their duties, not mooning over each other. She did not raise her voice, yet color appeared in Denny's round cheeks, and she stopped smiling and started watching the corridor again. It was better that way, perhaps, yet still a pity. Somebody ought to have a little pleasure in their lives. The map room was the second largest ballroom in the palace, and spacious, with four red-streaked marble fireplaces where small fires burned beneath the carved mantels, a domed ceiling worked with gilt and supported by widely spaced columns, two spans from white marble walls that had been stripped of tapestries, and sufficient mirrored stand lamps to light the room as well as if it had windows. The greatest part of its tile floor was a detailed mosaic map of Camelin, originally laid down above 1,000 years ago, after the new city had been completed, though before Low Camelin began growing. Long before there was an Andor, even before Arthur Hawkwing. It had been redone several times since, as tiles faded or became worn, so every street was exact. At least they had been until today. The lights end they still were. And despite many buildings replaced over the years, even some of the alleys were unchanged from what the huge map showed. There would be no dancing in the map room for the foreseeable future, however. Long tables between the columns held more maps, some large enough to spill over the edges, and shelves along the walls held stacks of reports, those not so sensitive they needed to be locked away, or else committed to memory and burned. Birgitta's wide writing table, nearly covered with baskets, most full of papers, stood at the far end of the room. As Captain General, she had her own study, but as soon as she discovered the map room, she had decided the map in the floor made it too good not to use. A small wooden disc, painted red, marked the spot on the outer wall where the assault had just been beaten back. Birgitta scooped it up in passing and tossed it into a round basket full of the things on her writing table. Elaine shook her head. It was a small basket, but if there were enough attacks at once to need that many markers.
"My Lady Birgitta, I have that report on available fodder you asked for," a graying woman said, holding out a page covered with neat lines. The white lion was worked small on the breast of her neat brown dress. Five other clerks went on with their work, pens scritching. They were among Master Norrie's most trusted, and Mistress Harfour had personally screened the half-dozen messengers in red and white livery, swift young men, boys really, who stood against the wall behind the clerk's small writing tables. One, a pretty youth, began a bow before cutting it short with a blush. Birgitta had settled the question of courtesies to her or other nobles with very few words. Work came first, and any noble who disliked that could just avoid the map room.
"Thank you, Mr. Sanford. I'll look at it later. If you and the others will wait outside, please."
Mistress Anford quickly gathered up the messengers and the other clerks, giving them only time to stopper their ink jars and blot their work. No one showed a glimmer of surprise. They were accustomed to the need for privacy at times. Elaine had heard people call the map room the secrets room, though nothing very secret was kept there. All of that was locked away in her apartments. While the clerks and messengers were filing out, Elaine strode to one of the long tables where a map showed Camelin and its surroundings for at least 50 miles in each direction. Even the Black Tower had been inked in, a square sitting less than 2 leagues south of the city. A growth on Andor, and no way to be rid of it. She still sent parties of guardsmen to inspect some days via gateways, but the place was large enough that the Ashaman could have been up to anything without her learning of it. Pins with enameled heads marked Aramilla's 8 camps around the city, and small metal figures various other camps. A falcon, finely wrought in gold and no taller than her little finger, showed where the Goshen were, or had been. Were they gone yet? She slipped the falcon into her belt pouch. Avienda was very much a falcon. On the other side of the table, Birgitta raised a questioning eyebrow.
"They're gone, or going," Elaine told her. There would be visits. Avienda was not gone forever.
Sent somewhere by Rand.
Where, I don't know, burn him.
I wondered why Avienda wasn't with you.
Elaine laid one finger atop a bronze horseman less than a hand tall, standing a few leagues west of the city.
Someone needs to take a look at Davram Bashir's camp.
Find out whether the Saldaeans are leaving too, and the Legion of the Dragon. It did not matter if they were, really. They had not interfered in matters, thank the light, and the time when fear that they might restrained Aramilla was long past. But she disliked things happening in Andor without her knowledge. Send guardsmen to the Black Tower tomorrow as well. Tell them to count how many Ashaman they see. So he's planning a big battle. Another big battle. Against the Seanchan, I suppose. Folding her arms beneath her breasts, Birgitta frowned at the map. I'd wonder where and when, except we have enough in front of us to be going on with. The map displayed the reasons Aramilla was pressing so hard. For one, to the northeast of Camelin, almost off the map, lay the bronze image of a sleeping bear curled up with its paws over its nose. 200,000 men, near enough, almost as many trained men as all of Andor could field. 4 borderland rulers, accompanied by perhaps a dozen Aes Sedai they tried to keep hidden, searching for Rand, their reasons unstated. Borderlanders had no cause to turn against Rand that she could see, though the simple fact was he had not bound them to him as he had other lands. But Aes Sedai were another matter, especially with their allegiance uncertain, and 12 approached a dangerous number even for him. While the 4 rulers had in part deciphered her motives for asking them into Andor, yet she had managed to mislead them concerning Rand's whereabouts. Unfortunately, the Borderlanders had belied every tale of how swiftly they could move as they crept south, and now they sat in place, trying to find a way to avoid coming near a city under siege. That was understandable, even laudable. Outland armies in close proximity to Andorran armsmen on Andorran soil would make for a touchy situation. There were always at least a few hotheads. Bloodshed and maybe war could start all too easily under those circumstances. Even so, bypassing Camelin was going to be difficult. The narrow country roads had been turned to bogs by the rains, giving hard passage to an army that large. Elaine could have wished they had marched another 20 or 30 miles toward Camelin, though. She had hoped their presence would have had a different effect by now. It might still. More importantly, certainly to Aramilla, and possibly to herself, a few leagues below the Black Tower stood a tiny silver swordsman, with his blade upright in front of him, and a silver halberdier, plainly by the same silversmith's hand, one to the west of the Black Square, the other to the east. Luon, Elorian, and Abella, Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pelivar had close to 60,000 men between them in those 2 camps. Their estates and those of the nobles tied to them must have been stripped near the bone. Those 2 camps were where Dailin had been these past 3 days, trying to learn their intentions. The spindly guardsman opened one of the doors and held it for an elderly serving woman carrying a rope-work silver tray with 2 tall golden wine pitchers and a circle of goblets made of blue seafolk porcelain. Rena must have been uncertain how many would be present. The frail woman moved slowly, careful not to tilt the heavy tray and drop anything. Elaine channeled flows of air to take the tray, then let them dissipate, unused. Implying that the woman could not do her job would only be hurtful. She was effusive in her thanks, though. The old woman smiled broadly, clearly delighted, and offered her a deep curtsy, once unburdened of the tray. Dailin arrived almost right behind the maid, an image of vigor, and shooed her out before grimacing over the contents of 1 pitcher. Elaine sighed. Doubtless it held goat's milk, and filling a goblet from the other. Plainly, Dailin had confined her freshening to washing her face and brushing her hair, golden flecked with gray, because her dark gray riding dress with a large round silver pin worked with Taravin's owl and oak on the high neck had spots of half-dried mud on the skirts. "There's something seriously amiss," she said, swirling the wine in her goblet without drinking. A frown deepened the fine lines at the corners of her eyes. "I've been in this palace more times than I can remember, and today I got lost 2x." "We know about that," Elaine told her, and quickly explained what little they had puzzled out, what she intended to do. Belatedly, she wove a ward against eavesdropping and was unsurprised to feel it slice through Sidar. At least whoever had been listening in would get a jolt from that. A small jolt, since so little of the power was involved that she had not sensed it. Maybe there was a way to make it a hard jolt next time, though. Maybe that would begin to discourage eavesdroppers.
So, it might happen again, Dialin said when Elaine was done.
Her tone was calm, but she licked her lips and took a swallow of wine, as if her mouth was suddenly dry.
Well then, if you don't know what caused it and you don't know whether it will happen again, what are we to do?
Elaine stared. Again, someone seemed to think she had answers she did not. But then, that was what it meant to be queen. You were always expected to have an answer, to find one. That was what it meant to be Aes Sedai. We can't stop it, so we'll live with it, Dailin, and try to keep people from growing too afraid. I'll announce what happened as much as we know and have the other sisters do the same. That way people will know that Aes Sedai are aware, and that should provide some comfort. A little. They'll still be frightened, of course, but not as much as they'll be if we say nothing and it does happen again. That seemed a feeble effort to her. But surprisingly, Dailin agreed without hesitation.
I myself can suggest nothing else to be done. Most people think you, Aes Sedai, can handle anything. It should suffice in the circumstances.
And when they realized that Aes Sedai could not handle anything, that she could not? Well, that was a river that she would cross when she reached it.
Is the news good or bad?
Before Dailin could answer, the door opened again.
I heard that Lady Dailin had returned. You should have sent for us, Elaine. You aren't queen yet, and I dislike you keeping secrets from me. Where is Avienda?
Catalin Haven, a cool-eyed, ungovernable young woman, a girl, in truth, still long months short of her majority, though her guardian had abandoned her to go her own way, was pride to her toenails, her plump chin held high. Of course, that might have been because of the large enameled pin of Haven's blue bear that decorated the high neck of her blue riding dress. She had begun showing Dailin respect and a certain wariness shortly after she started sharing a bed with her and Sergei's, but with Elaine she insisted on every perquisite of a high seat.
"We all heard," Conall Northen said.
Lean and tall in a red silk coat with laughing eyes and an eagle's beak of a nose, he was of age, just a few months past his 16th name day. He swaggered and caressed the hilt of his sword much too fondly, but there seemed no harm in him, only boyishness, an unfortunate trait in a high seat.
"And none of us could wait to hear when Luon and the others will join us. This pair would have run the whole way."
He ruffled the hair of the two younger boys with him, Perival Mantiar and Branlet Gilliard, who gave him a dark look and raked fingers through his hair to straighten it. Perival blushed. Quite short, but already pretty, he was the youngest at 12, yet Branlet had only a year on him. Elaine sighed, but she could not ask them to leave. Children, most of them might be, perhaps all, considering Conile's behavior. Yet they were the high seats of their houses, and along with Dailin, her most important allies. She did wish she knew how they had learned the purpose of Dailin's journey. That had been intended to be a secret until she knew what news Dailin brought. Another task for Rena. Gossip unchecked, the wrong gossip, could be as dangerous as spies.
"Where is Avienda?" Catalin demanded.
Strangely, she had become quite taken with Avienda. Fascinated might have been a better word. Of all things, she had persisted in trying to make Avienda teach her to use a spear.
"So, my lady," Conall said, strolling over to fill a blue goblet with wine. "When are they joining us?"
"The bad news is that they aren't," Dailin said calmly. "The good news is that they've each rejected an invitation to join Aramilla."
She cleared her throat loudly as Branlet reached for the wine pitcher. His cheeks reddened, and he picked up the other pitcher as if he had really meant to all along. The high seat of House Gilliard, yet still a boy for all of the sword on his hip. Perival also wore a sword, one that dragged on the floor tiles and looked too big for him, but he had already taken goat's milk. Pouring her own wine, Catalin smirked at the younger boys, a superior smile that vanished when she noticed Dailin looking at her.
"That's small turnips to call good news," Birgitta said. "Burn me if it isn't. You bring back a bloody half-starved squirrel and call it a side of beef."
"Pungent, as always," Dailin said dryly. The two women glared at one another, Birgitta's hands balling into fists, Dailin fingering the dagger at her belt.
"No arguing," Elaine said, making her voice sharp.
The anger in the bond helped. At times she feared the pair might come to blows.
"I won't put up with your bickering today." "Where is Avienda?"
"Gone, Catalin."
"What else did you learn, Dailin?"
"Gone where?"
"Gone away," Elaine said calmly.
Sidar or no Sidar, she wanted to slap the girl's face.
"Dailin?"
The older woman took a sip of wine to cover breaking off her staring match with Birgitta. Coming to stand beside Elaine, she picked up the silver swordsman, turned him over, set him down again. "Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellivar tried to convince me to announce a claim to the throne, but they were less adamant than when I spoke with them last. I believe I've almost convinced them I won't do it."
"Almost?"
Birgitta put 100 weight of derision in the word. Dailin ignored her pointedly. Elaine frowned at Birgitta, who shifted uncomfortably and stalked off long enough to get herself a goblet of wine.
Very satisfying. Whatever she was doing right, she hoped it continued to work.
"My lady," Perival said with a bow, extending one of 2 goblets he held to Elaine. She managed a smile and a curtsy before taking the offering.
Goat's milk. Light, but she was beginning to revile the stuff.
"Luan and Abella were noncommittal," Dailin continued, frowning at the halberdier. "They may be swaying toward you." She hardly sounded as though she believed it, however. "I reminded Luan that he helped me arrest Neon and Elania back in the beginning, but that may have done no more good than it did with Pellivar."
"So they may all be waiting for Aramilla to win," Birgitta said grimly. "If you survive, they'll declare for you against her. If you don't, one of them will make her own claim." "Elorian has the next best right after you, doesn't she?"
Dailin scowled, but she offered no denials.
"And Elorian?" Elaine asked quietly. She was sure she knew the answer there already. Her mother had had Elorian flogged. That had been under Ravine's influence, but few seemed to believe that. Few seemed to believe Gabriel had even been Ravine.
Dailin grimaced.
"The woman's head is stone. She'd announce a claim in my name if she thought it would do any good. At least she has enough sense to see it won't."
Elaine noted that she made no mention of any claims in Elorian's own name.
"In any case, I left Corylus or Tophni and Julania Fote to watch them. I doubt they'll move, but if they do, we'll know straight away."
3 kinswomen who needed to form a circle to travel were watching the Borderlanders for the same reason.
"No good news at all, then, no matter what face Dailin tried to put on it." Elaine had hoped the threat of the Borderlanders would drive some of the houses to support her.
"At least one reason I let them cross Andor still holds," she thought grimly. Even if she failed to gain the throne, she had done that service for Andor. Unless whoever did take the throne bungled matters completely. She could see Aramilla doing just that. Well, Aramilla was not going to wear the rose crown, and that was that. One way or another, she had to be stopped.
"So it's 6, 6, and 6. Catalin said, frowning and thumbing the long signet ring on her left hand. She looked thoughtful, unusual for her. Her usual style was to speak her mind with no consideration whatsoever.
"Even if Candreid joins us, we are short of 10.
Was she wondering whether she had tied Haven to a hopeless cause?
Unfortunately, she had not tied her house so tightly the knots could not be undone.
"I was certain Luan would join us," Conail muttered. "And Abella and Pellivar." He took a deep swallow of wine. "Once we beat Aramilla, they'll come. You mark me on it."
"But what are they thinking?" Branlett demanded. "Are they trying to start a war with 3 sides?
His voice went from treble to bass halfway through that, and his face flushed with red. He buried his face in his goblet, but grimaced. Apparently he liked goat's milk as little as she did. "It's the Borderlanders." Perival's voice was a boy's piping, but he sounded sure of himself. "They're holding back because whoever wins here, the Borderlanders still have to be dealt with." He picked up the bear, hefting it as if its weight would give him answers. "What I don't understand is why they're invading us in the first place. We're so far from the Borderlands. And why haven't they marched on and attacked Camelin? They could sweep Aramilla aside, and I doubt we could keep them out as easily as we do her. So why are they here?" Smiling, Conail clapped him on the shoulder.
"Now that will be a battle to see when we face the Borderlanders. Northen's eagles and Mantiar's anvil will do Andor proud that day, eh?"
Perival nodded, but he did not look happy at the prospect. Conail certainly did. Elaine exchanged glances with Dailin and Birgitta, both of whom looked amazed. Elaine felt astonished herself. The other two women knew, of course, but little Perival had come near touching a secret that had to be kept. Others might puzzle out eventually that the Borderlanders had been meant to push houses into joining her, but it must not be confirmed. "Luan and the others sent to Aramilla asking for a truce until the Borderlanders were turned back," Dailin said after a moment. "She asked time to consider. As near as I can calculate, it was then that she began increasing her efforts at the walls. She tells them she's still considering."
"Aside from anything else," Catalan said heatedly, "that shows why Aramilla doesn't deserve the throne. She puts her own ambition above Andor's safety. Luan and the others must be fools not to see it."
"Not fools," Dailin replied. "Just men and women who think they see the future better than they do." What if she and Dailin were the ones who were not seeing the future clearly, Elaine wondered. To save Andor, she would have thrown her support to Dailin. Not gladly, but to save Andor's blood, she would have. Dailin would have the support of 10 houses, more than 10. Even Danin Kandreyed might finally decide to stir herself in support of Dailin. Except that Dailin did not want to be queen. She believed that Elaine was the one to wear the rose crown. So did Elaine. But what if they were wrong? Not the first time that question had come to her, but now, staring at the map with all of its ill tidings, she could not shake free of it. That evening, after a dinner memorable only for the surprise of tiny strawberries, she sat in the large sitting room of her apartments reading. Trying to read. The leather-bound book was a history of Andor, as was most of her reading of late. It was necessary to read as many as possible to gain any real version of truth, cross-checking one against another. For one thing, a book first published during any monarch's reign never mentioned any of her missteps or those of her immediate predecessors if they were of her own house. You had to read books written while Trakand held the throne to learn of Mantiar's mistakes, and books written under Mantiar to learn of Norwellen's errors. Others' mistakes could teach her how not to make the same herself. Her mother had made that almost her first lesson. She could not concentrate, however. She often found herself staring at a page without seeing a word, thinking of her sister, or starting to say something to Avienda before remembering that she was not there. She felt very lonely, which was ridiculous. Stephanie stood in a corner against the possibility she wanted anything. 8 guardswomen were standing outside the door to the apartments. And one of them, Urith Azeri, was an excellent conversationalist, an educated woman, though silent on her past. But none of them was Avienda. When Van Deen glided into the room, followed by Christian and Zarya, it seemed a relief. The 2 white-clad women stopped by the doorway, expressions meek. Untouched by the oath rod, pale Christian, hands folded at her waist, appeared just into her middle years. Zarya, with her tilted eyes and hooked nose, well short of them. She held something wrapped in white toweling.
"Forgive me if I'm interrupting," Van Deen began, then frowned. The white-haired green's face somehow gave an impression of age despite her Aes Sedai features. Those could have been 20 or 40 or anything in between. That seemed to change at every blink. Perhaps it was her dark eyes, luminous and deep and pained, which had seen so much. There was an air of tiredness about her, too. Her back was straight, but she still looked weary.
"It is none of my business, of course," she said delicately. "But is there a reason you are holding so much of the power? I thought you must be weaving something very complex when I felt you in the corridor." With a start, Elaine realized that she held nearly as much of Sayadar as she could contain safely. How had that happened? She did not recall drawing any deeper. Hastily, she released the source, regret filling her as the power drained away, and the world became ordinary again. On the instant, her mood bounced sideways. "You aren't interrupting anything," she said peevishly, setting her book down on the table in front of her. She had not finished 3 pages of the thing anyway. "May I make us private, then?" Elaine gave a curt nod. It was none of the woman's bloody business how much of the power she held. She knew the protocols as well as Elaine, or better, and told Stephanie to wait in the anteroom while Van Deen wove a ward against eavesdropping. Ward or no ward, Van Deen waited until the door closed behind the maid before speaking. "Rihanna Corley is dead, Elaine."
"Oh, light! No!"
Temper vanished into sobs, and she hastily snatched a lace-edged handkerchief from her sleeve to blot the tears suddenly streaming down her cheeks. Her cursed, shifting moods at work. Yet Rihanna surely deserved tears. She had so wanted to become a green.
"How?"
Burn her. She wished she could stop blubbering. There were no tears from Van Deen. Perhaps there were no more tears in her. "She was smothered with the power. Whoever did it used much more than was needed. The residues of Sayadar were thick on her and in the room where she was found. The murderer wanted to be sure no one would miss seeing how she died."
"That makes no sense, Van Deen."
"Perhaps it does. Zarya." The Saldaean woman laid her small bundle on the table and unwrapped it to reveal an articulated wooden doll. It was very old, the simple dress threadbare, the painted face flaking and missing an eye, half of its long, dark hair gone.
"This belonged to Miraine Larinan," Zarya said. "Deris Nirmala found it behind a cupboard."
"I don't see what Miraine leaving a doll behind has to do with Rihanna's death," Elaine said, wiping her eyes. "Miraine was one of the kinswomen who had run away."
"Only this," Van Deen answered. "When Miraine went to the tower, she hid this doll outside because she had heard that everything she owned would be burned. After she was put out, she retrieved it and always carried it with her, always. She had a quirk, though. Wherever she stopped for a time, she hid the doll again. Do not ask me why, but she would not have run away and abandoned it." Still dabbing at her eyes, Elaine leaned back in her chair. Her weeping had dwindled to sniffles, but her eyes still leaked tears.
"So, Miraine didn't run away. She was murdered and disposed of,
a grisly way to put it. The others too, you think? All of them?" Van Deen nodded, and for a moment her slender shoulders slumped. "I very much fear so," she said, straightening. "I expect clues were left among the things they left behind. Treasured keepsakes like this doll, a favorite piece of jewelry. The murderer wanted us to think she was being clever at hiding her crimes, but not clever enough. Only we weren't clever enough to find those clues, so she decided to become more blatant." "To frighten the kinswoman into fleeing," Elaine muttered. "That would not cripple her, but it would throw her back on the mercies of the Windfinders, and those seemed to be growing mingy."
"How many of them know of this?"
"All by now, I should think," Van Deen said dryly. "Zarya told Deris to keep quiet, but that woman likes the sound of her own voice."
"This seems aimed at me, at helping Aramilla gain the throne. But why would a black sister have any interest in that? I can't think we have 2 murderers among us."
"At least this settles the question of Marilla. Speak with Sumiko and Elise, Van Deen. They can make sure the rest don't panic." Sumiko ranked next after Rihanna, as the kin ordered their hierarchy, and while Elise stood much lower, she was a woman of great influence. "From now on, none of them is to be alone. Not ever.
Always at least two together, and three or four would be better. And warn them to be careful of Kariana and Saritha.
I'd advise against that, Van Deen said quickly. They should be safe in groups, and word would reach Kariana and Saritha. Warned against Aes Sedai? The kin would give themselves away in a minute.
Christian and Zarya nodded solemnly. After a moment, Elaine reluctantly agreed to the continued secrecy. The kin should be safe in groups.
Let Shanella know about Rihanna and the others. I can't imagine the Windfinders are in any danger. Losing them wouldn't hurt me the way losing the kin would, but wouldn't it be wonderful if they did decide to leave?
She did not expect that they would. Shanella feared returning to the Seafolk with the bargain unfulfilled, yet it would be a bright spot in an otherwise miserable day if they did. At least it seemed unlikely anything could darken the day further. The thought sent a chill through her. The lights and nothing would darken it more.
Aramilla pushed her plate of stew away with a grimace. She'd been offered her choice of beds for the night. Arlene, her maid, was making the choice now. The woman knew what she liked. And the least she had expected was a decent meal, but the mutton was fatty and definitely beginning to go rancid besides. There had been too much of that lately. This time the cook was going to be flogged. She was unsure which of the nobles in this camp employed him, just that he was supposed to be the best at hand. The best! But that did not matter. He would be flogged to make an example, and then sent away, of course. You could never trust a cook after he'd been punished. The mood in the tent was far from lively. Several of the nobles in the camp had hoped for invitations to dine with her, but none stood high enough. She was beginning to regret not asking one or two, even some of Nayan or Elania's people. They might have been entertaining. Her closest allies at table together, and you might have thought they sat over funeral meats. Oh, scrawny old Nason, his thinning white hair uncombed, was eating away heartily, apparently not noticing that the meat was nearly rotten, and giving her fatherly pats on the hand. She met his smiles like a dutiful daughter. The fool was wearing one of his flower-embroidered coats tonight. The thing could have passed for a woman's dressing robe. Happily, his leers were all directed down the table at Elania. The honey-haired woman flinched, her fox-like face paling whenever she glanced at him. She controlled House Sarand as if she were the high seat instead of her husband, yet she feared that Aramilla would still let Nason have his way with her. That threat was unneeded now, but it was well to have it to hand just in case. Yes, Nason was happy enough in his futile pursuit of Elania, but the others were sunk in gloom. Their plates were abandoned, barely touched, and they kept her two serving men trotting to refill wine cups. She never liked trusting others' servants. At least the wine had not turned.
"I still say we should make a heavier push," Lear grumbled drunkenly into his cup. A whip of a man, his red coat showing the wear of armor straps, the high seat of Baron was ever eager to strike. Subtlety was simply beyond him. "My eyes and ears report more armsmen entering the city every day through these gateways."
He shook his head and muttered something under his breath.
The man actually believed those rumors of dozens of Aes Sedai in the royal palace. All these pinprick attacks do is lose men.
I agree, Carand said, fiddling with a large golden pin enameled with the running red fox of Anshar that was fastened to her bosom. She was not much less intoxicated than Lear. Her square face had a slackness about it.
We need to press home instead of throwing men away. Once we're over the walls, our advantage in numbers will pay off.
Aramilla's mouth tightened. They might at least show her the respect due a woman who was soon to be queen of Andor, rather than disagreeing with her all the time. Unfortunately, Baron and Anshar were not bound to her so tightly as Sarand and Aron. Unlike Jared and Nayan, Lear and Carand had announced their support of her without publishing it in writing. Neither had Nason, but she had no fear of losing him. Him she had wound around her wrist for a bracelet. Forcing a smile, she made her voice jovial.
We lose mercenaries. What else are mercenaries good for if not dying in place of our armsmen?
She held up her wine cup, and a lean man in her silver-trimmed blue hastened to fill it. In fact, he was so hasty that he spilled a drop on her hand.
Her scowl made him snatch a handkerchief from his pocket to blot up the drop before she could pull her hand away. His handkerchief! The light only knew where that filthy thing had been, and he had touched her with it. His mouth writhed with fear as he retreated, bowing and mumbling apologies. Let him serve out the meal. He could be dismissed after. We will need all of our armsmen when I ride against the Borderlanders. Don't you agree, Nayan? Nayan twitched as though stuck with a pin. Slim and pale in yellow silk worked with silver patterns of Aron's triple keys on the breast, she had begun looking haggard in recent weeks, her blue eyes drawn and tired. All of her supercilious airs were quite gone. Of course, Aramilla, she said meekly and drained her cup. Good. She and Delania were definitely tamed, but Aramilla liked to check now and then to make sure neither was growing a new backbone. If Luon and the others will not support you, what good will taking Camelin do? Sylvaise, Nason's granddaughter and heir, spoke so seldom that the question came as a shock. Sturdy and not quite pretty, she usually had a vapid gaze, but her blue eyes appeared quite sharp at the moment. Everyone stared at her. That seemed not to faze her a bit. She toyed with a wine cup, but Aramilla thought it no more than her second. If we must fight the Borderlanders, why not accept Luan's truce, so Andor can field its full strength unhindered by divisions? Aramilla smiled. She wanted to slap the silly woman. Nason would be angered by that, however. He wanted her kept as Aramilla's guest to prevent his removal as high seat. Part of him seemed aware that his wits were gone. All of him intended holding on as high seat until he died, but he did love her. Elorian and some of the others will come to me yet, child, she said smoothly. Smoothness required some effort. Who did the chit think she was? Aemlyn, Aracella, Pellavar, they have grievances against Trakand. Surely they would come once Elaine and Dailan were out of the way. Those two would not survive Camelin's fall. Once I have the city, they will be mine in any event. Three of Elaine's supporters are children, and Conail Northen is little more than a child. I trust I can convince them to publish their support of me easily enough. And if she could not, Master Lunalt surely could. A pity if children had to be handed over to him and his cords. I will be queen by sunset of the day Camelin falls to me. Isn't that right, father? Nason laughed, spraying gobbets of half-chewed stew across the table. Yes, yes, he said, patting Aramilla's hand. You listen to your aunt, Sylvaise. Do as she tells you. She'll be Queen of Andor soon. His smile faded, and an odd note entered his voice. It might almost have been pleading. Remember, you will be High Seat of Cairn after I'm gone. After I'm gone, you will be High Seat.
As you say, Grandfather, Sylvaise murmured, inclining her head briefly. When she straightened, her gaze was as insipid as ever. The sharpness must have been a trick of the light. Of course. Nason grunted and went happily back to wolfing down the stew.
Best I've had in days. I think I'll have another plate. More wine here, man. Can't you see my cup's dry?
The silence around the table stretched in discomfort. Nason's more open displays of senility had a way of causing that.
I still say, Lear began finally, only to cut off as a stocky armsman with Marn's four silver moons on his chest entered the tent.
Bowing respectfully, the fellow made his way around the table and bent to whisper in Aramilla's ear.
Master Hernville asks a word in private, my lady.
Everyone but Nason and his granddaughter pretended to concentrate on their wine, certainly not attempting to eavesdrop. He went on eating. She watched Aramilla, bland-faced. That sharpness must have been a trick of the light. I'll be but a few moments, Aramilla said, rising. She waved a hand, indicating the food and wine.
Enjoy yourselves until I return. Enjoy.
Lear called for more wine. Outside, she did not bother raising her skirts to keep them clear of the mud.
Arlene would already have to clean them, so what did a little more mud matter? Light showed in some tents, but by and large the camp was dark beneath a half-moon. Jacob Hernville, her secretary, waited a little away from the tent in a plain coat, holding a lantern that made a yellow pool around him. He was a little man and lean, as if all the fat had been boiled from him. Discretion was bred in his bones, and she ensured his loyalty by paying him enough that only the largest bribes could be of interest, far more than anyone would offer a scrivener.
"Forgive me for interrupting your meal, my lady," he said with a bow, "but I was sure you would want to hear right away."
It was always a surprise hearing such a deep voice from such a tiny man.
"They have agreed, but they want the whole amount of gold first."
Her lips compressed of their own accord. The whole amount. She had hoped to get off with paying only the first half. After all, who would dare dun her once she was queen? "Draw up a letter to Mistress Andscale. I'll sign and seal it first thing in the morning." Transferring that much gold would require days. And how long to have the armsmen ready? She had never really paid attention to that sort of thing. Lear could tell her, but she hated showing weakness. "Tell them a week from tomorrow to the day." That should be enough. In a week, Camelin would be hers. The throne would be hers. Aramilla, by the grace of the light, queen of Andor, defender of the realm, protector of the people, high seat of House Marn. Smiling, she went back inside to tell the others the wonderful news.